From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Speaker of the House of Commons has been accused of an obscene waste of taxpayers' money. In one case, John Bercow claimed £367 to be driven to a speech about the MP's expenses scandal. Andy Sylvester from the Taxpayers Alliance says there are other examples too.
It is almost inconceivable how a journey of less than a mile could cost £172. You could fly to Rome on Ryanair for about that much money. So we have to ask serious questions of whoever was in charge of these arrangements and why the Speaker at some point hasn't flagged up the fact that clearly this isn't appropriate.
Well, the Speaker's office insists chauffeur-driven cars are sometimes needed for events. In other news, US police are trying to work out why a gunman opened fire in a cinema, killing two people. It happened in the city of Lafayette in Louisiana. Matt Steele reports.
Moviegoers say there was confusion inside the cinema.
We hear some loud pops.
I had no idea what was going on.
The lights go on.
I just grabbed my child and we just all ran.
It was 20 minutes into a showing of Trainwreck that 59-year-old John Hauser stood up and opened fire, but police don't know why.
He's kind of a drifter.
He killed two women and then himself, although it seems he planned to escape.
We found some wigs, glasses, things that, you know, a person could use to maybe change their appearance.
Amy Schumer, who stars in Trainwreck, tweeted that her heart is broken.
Ministers say there are no plans to change the law on smacking children. That's despite the UN Human Rights Committee calling for a ban on physical punishments. Two British men have died while racing their cars on a mountain road in southwestern Austria. Their vehicle dropped around 400 metres near a village east of Innsbruck. The Clutha Bar in Glasgow is reopening nearly 2 years after a police helicopter crashed through its roof. 10 people died in the accident. Among those who'll be attending the pub are relatives of the victims. And one of wrestling's most famous names, Hulk Hogan, has had his contract terminated by WWE. It's reportedly because of an audio recording of Hogan that surfaced. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show. Yes, after a week's break for the good old Harbour Festival, we're back. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is one of the two shortlisted so far for Bristol Labour Party Mayor candidate, Marvin Rees. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, drugs as weapons against the people. Well, that's what a book by US author John Potash attempts to prove. He links the deaths of many well-known musicians to a system of CIA entrapment and then discrediting or death part of the CIA programme known as MKUltra. Also, it's big in Australia, but not here. ABC Television's 60 Minutes show last Sunday had an hour-long expose of the British Whitehall Westminster VI paedophile cover-up, but it wasn't reported at all here in the UK, let alone shown. What were they saying down under? And the largest targets in the war on terror, broadcasters, universities and internet service providers, the very people who are exposing it as a lie. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots over the last 2 weeks. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and showers, as you can see if you look out your window, and also highs of 21 degrees Celsius this weekend. Sunnier on Saturday, so the rain will clear up overnight. Cloudier with also some showers on Sunday. So if you want to get out and about, do it on Saturday. Next week, highs of 18 Celsius, cloud cover and rain. We've got plenty of sunny spells and plenty of showers next week. Next weekend, the 1st and 2nd of August, highs of 21 Celsius with sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's one of the two shortlisted people so far for Bristol Labour Party Mayor candidate Marvin Rees. Hi Marvin, welcome to the Politics Show.
Thanks very much.
Marvin, how does this process work? So several people have put their hats into the ring, but only two have actually been shortlisted.
Yeah, so it opens up, they send a notice out informing people that they can put their applications in. We put our applications in, then we go for interview, and they choose the shortlist from the interview, and then the shortlist goes to the party membership to then have a vote on who they want to be the candidates.
So who's doing the interview? Is it some sort of like local regional Labour Party executive?
Yeah. Yeah, it's members. It was representatives from the four constituencies, a couple of people from the region. So it's quite a big panel. There's probably about seven or eight people actually interviewing us on the shortlisting day.
Okay. Also, I mean, it seems very strange you're standing again, because you stood last time and you didn't win and you lost against George Ferguson. You're up against him again. What makes you think, you know, you can do things differently this time?
First of all, let's address this thing about standing. I mean, I'm a sportsman. Sometimes we lose and we come back and we try again. This thing about, well, that's it, one show and you're out, I think is not a good message. And in fact, I work with a lot of young people in the city, and one of the things that we talk to them about a lot is if you're going to have aspirations to be more than your background says you should be, buckle up, because sometimes you're going to bump into bumps on the road and you're not going to make it. But that doesn't mean you quit. That doesn't mean you give up. So certainly not. I mean, the grand theme of that is one that I object to ferociously personally. But actually, in terms of the outcome of the election, we've got to think about what happened as well. We got a very large number of votes. We had over 35,000 votes. George won with 36,000. We had over 30,000. The next place candidate had 7,000 or 8,000. So actually, I think we upheld the vote quite well in quite tough circumstances. George played a very strong line around, you know, the reason that the world is going to a pot is because of party politics. Of course, we know it's more than that. It's about the way the global economy works. It's about many issues. Very simplistic just to blame party politics. And there are all sorts of clubs running the city as well that are well beyond party politics. And I'm not a member of those clubs.
George would say neither is he anymore.
Well, I mean, we know, yeah, there's a very interesting report come out last year on the social mobility called Elitist Britain. And what it talks about is actually that it's your socioeconomic background that determines where you end up in life. So if you're born into privilege, like some people are and some people are not, if you're born into privilege, it means you're more likely to end up in a position of leadership. So when we're talking about who runs this country and who runs this city and how the world works, it's not simply about you become a member of a political party, so you become a member of the elite ruling class. It's about the context in which you're born into. It's about the 7% of people who were born into private schools who end up running this country.
So
this is a massive problem.
Ed Miliband lost the general election, but you think he should be still allowed to stand for the next general election and to possibly lose that too?
Well, I don't find the logic of your argument. I'm just saying, in my personal story, I found that not being a quitter actually quite helps you. And the message I'm sharing with many young people that come from backgrounds like mine is, when you try and do things, sometimes you don't always make it first time. But I think there are enough positive signals. And when I walk around the areas I grew up in, around Eastern and around St. Paul's, and I see people, particularly older Jamaican people who followed my campaign, a number of them are saying, please, you know, good on you, son. You did our community proud. We came here with nothing. We made something at it, you know, in this country, and we're proud of the start you made, and we hope you're going to go again.
What about, City Region Mayor, they're talking about that now. Aren't events overtaking you? Because it looks like there's going to be some, possibly anyway, this has certainly been discussed, a mayor for a bigger region than just Bristol in the future.
I think the important thing for the region is that where we need to work cooperatively across boundaries, whatever shape that takes, that we do it. Now, clearly on issues of transport, on housing, on how we manage the economy, we can't just be navel-gazing within the boundaries of the city. The question of whether you have a single political position that has authority across those areas is another question. Is an incredibly sensitive question as well, not least because in South Gloucestershire, in Baines, in North Somerset as well, they've developed their own own political identities now. But certainly, you know, we need to be prepared on those flagship issues to work across those those geographical boundaries.
We've had a few years of George now, a little bit less than a year to go until this election next May for mayor again. What would you have done different? I mean, you've obviously had a bit of, you would probably been looking at stuff and saying, well, if I'd have been in there, I would have done this differently. So give us headlines of two or three things that you think you would have really made a difference in the city if you'd have been elected, not George.
Well, I think first off, actually, if you can watch my concession speech online, and I shared when when I was up at UWE, what I thought the priorities, how you needed to set this thing out. I think clearly, first off, you needed to set a long-term vision for Bristol. Now,
you know, but I'm talking about specific things that George has done.
Let's work it out, because you can get, you know, analogy I would use. I used to play a lot of rugby. We all know we're supposed to score tries, but until you work out where everyone's playing and what they're supposed to be doing, it becomes a mess, right? So I think there has been no agreed priority for what the city is for, what it's about. I mean, I actually think we should have been setting a clear priority that everything that we do and what we point our policy towards is about tackling child poverty and being a place that takes chunks out of child poverty. In terms of specifics of how we do it, I think, too, what we really needed to do was think about that this is, as I was very clear from the start, Bristol was always going to be ham-fisted if all they did was take the position of the mayor and stick them on the city council and expected things to run as normal. It had to be about trying to get Bristol working in a way in which boundaries would be crossed between organisations, between health and the police, and getting all our city institutions working together towards these shared priorities.
But one of the things George has said, Marvin, I just have to interrupt you, because one of the things that George has said is he sees jobs as a solution, because jobs filters down into all other areas. Say, for example, child poverty. If people have got jobs, actually what that does is that helps their kids too.
So, and then we come on to that. So we agreed priorities. We set up Bristol to be able to deliver. What do we need to prioritise? We needed to build affordable housing. We haven't built enough affordable housing in the city. What the holdup is beyond me, that we haven't just aligned ourselves to do it. It benefits from housing in terms of the local economy, family stability, educational start in life are absolutely clear. I think we should have set our stall out in making Bristol a living wage city, not as an afterthought, not as a temporary measure, but saying, because it's an indication of the kind of economic development we want to get in the city. Too long we've had an economic development that's about trickle down, and that's what we end up falling into, rather than saying this has to be a form of economic development and a prosperity in Bristol that is shared by all.
The Conservatives have picked up on that, haven't they? In the summer budget, they're going for the living wage.
I think that really sets a standard as to what you think the economy is about. Well, if they hadn't cut other things as well that actually leaves people worse off, then I think they'd have some integrity in saying that. But actually setting a stall out about how the economy is going to work was absolutely critical. We haven't taken any strong measures in the city on childcare. We had the debacle over the libraries, and I wouldn't have spent all my political capital on residence parking zones and 20 MPH. I think Bristol should be known as a city that's really set the standard in building a strong, inclusive economy that was bent on tackling poverty and building strong communities in the name of a prosperous future, rather than a city that was just about fun. Although we all want to have fun, I love St. Paul's Carnival, but those things need to happen in context. I mean, I grew up as a child in poverty in the city, single mum, lived in a refuge, lived on social security. My suggestion was my Sundays would have been much more special if I knew that on Monday we would have enough food to eat. And I think we need to kind of get some of these things in a bit of perspective.
The other thing that George promised when he first became mayor is he will be a strong voice for Bristol at Westminster. Now, a lot of us on this show week after week were saying, well, hang on, we can't do anything about this. Westminster's told us to do this. The big thing, of course, is the economy. Westminster is running the economy and it's telling us how much we've got to spend here in the city, for example. So what would you have been doing differently?
Well, again, it comes down to your sense of what leadership is and how it works. I struggle to see how one person, no matter how flamboyant, can go up to London and tell them, even though that was the promise, right, and it hasn't happened, the promise was there'd be a big voice, how one person can come up and do it. I think the authority of your voice in Westminster is not just down to the sheer force of your personality or the fact that you run a city council, it's down to the fact that you're genuinely speaking for a city. My point was, if you have done the piece of work about building relationships with the key institutions in the city, the health services, the police services in the business, then actually you can go up to London and you can say, you want to take £100 off our budget. What we're saying to you is not only how this is going to affect the local authority, you're talking about the implications this is going to have for the criminal justice service. You're talking about the implications this is going to have for population health and how much the clinical commissioning group are going to have to spend on hospital services in the future. So you go up with a proper city voice with the backing of your key city institutions. You've got business backing saying, if you cut £100 from this budget here, then what you're doing is you're undermining the basis of the education of our young people that we're going to be looking to employ in the future as our skilled workforce. So if you cut it, it's going to impact on us economically. Then you're not just going up there you know, shouting a ball, and if that's what happens, you're going up there with a strong reason case, with the backing of people that are saying, yeah, you're going there in our name. That gives you more power, and actually it gives you also power to go public on this thing. If you're not being listened to, go to the national press and your local press, so they know you're making your case,
if they listen.
Well, that's what I say, you know, if they listen. But maybe the other piece is to say to the, you know, to the Tories, I mean, one of the things I think that could be said to them is, you've made a big case about child poverty. Well, we agree with that, you know. A friend of mine who's an activist over in Luton has a great phrase. He says, occupy the rhetoric, you know. You've made a big case about child poverty. Okay, well, we want to do child poverty in Bristol, and this is what we're doing about it. But by the way, when you're foisting that cut upon us, you're cutting the legs out from us in terms of our ability to deliver on it.
Well, the other thing
want to think again.
The other thing they do is they actually say, well, we're going to change the way we measure it now, and actually that just all that's doing is fixing the figures.
Yeah, well, that's a problem too. Now, considering we have the Children of the 90s project in Bristol, and we have the other child poverty work coming out of Bristol University, we're probably in a good place to connect with them, and clearly we'd have to play a game using the national definitions of child poverty, but there's nothing to say that we can't develop on our own understanding and make our case locally to challenge that definition if we find it's not serving the people of Bristol.
Now, at the start, Marvin, you were talking about groups in the city, powerful groups that actually maybe have a big influence. What have you learnt about that, and how things work outside the political system? So in other words, outside the people we vote for.
Well, I've always thought that electoral politics, sometimes quite unfairly, has become a lightning rod for the world's ills. I think that many of the decisions that shape our lives are not necessarily made in the halls of democratic institutions, right? So I think, you know, for people that do rag on about elected politicians a lot, I think, you know, it is incumbent upon journalists to actually be saying, hey everybody, you know, it's not all happening at a Westminster, and it's not all happening at the City Council.
So if that's not where it's at, why do you want to be one?
Because it is a place where we can get some. It is a place where we can get some influence. And as I've said to a number of my friends who I've talked to about coming forward, we're not likely to become the chair of Barclays Bank or one of these other big financial institutions and manipulate the LIBOR interest rate to make our friends millions of pounds. But one of the most...
Sorry, hang on. I've got to stop you there. Commit fraud. That's fraud.
I
do put it that way. They talk about it. They talk about it as mis-selling, don't they?
Yeah.
This kind of thing. I call it fraud.
I don't want to get sidetracked here, but you get the point, right?
Yes,
you get the point.
I certainly do.
Those positions of influence and power are not as readily accessible to us as it is to go to the general public and put ourselves in front of them and get access to political office. Political office is not everything. It is not. It is not the defining feature of world power. Like, I'm sure you would. Well, I don't want to speak for you, but I'm sure we could have a conversation about Barack Obama and agree that just because he's president doesn't mean he gets to pull levers and make stuff happen by definition at the other end, right?
Even he certainly has influence, though, doesn't he?
It has influence, but I'm sure that when you become president, there are people who come out of the woodwork and say, welcome to the major leagues. Now you're competing with us, right?
So who really runs Bristol?
Well, I mean, it'd be a mix of things, won't it? It would be a mix of impersonal economic forces, right? The elements of the economy that are beyond the ability of any individual to control it, because it's just the way the economy works. There'll be powerful financial interests in the city. People who own swathes of land, and there'll be people who and this is not all conspiratorial. This is just the way stuff works. There'll be major employers who influence in people's lives. You know, you think of the size of our hospitals, you think of the size of our universities, employ major shape the lives of thousands of people in the city as their employers and their educators. So it's going to be a mix of all those things. And within those things, some institutions and some individuals will find themselves with more influence and power than others. And some will be using it in the name of the public good. I can think of some fantastic people who work in a health service in the city who make decisions, who have made decisions in the past, certainly on the basis of how can we make this a more just and fair city. There'll be other people in the city making decisions on how much money can we make.
So it's not the merchant venturers then, even though we've got two merchant venturers on Bristol Water, which is quite clearly the worst water company in the country. They've been told by Ofwat to drop their bills by, I think it's a third, and instead of doing that, they've set the lawyers on Ofwat, and now it looks like they're going to have to do that. So, not the Merchant Ventures.
Listen, I didn't say it was the Merchant Ventures. I didn't say it wasn't the Merchant Ventures. When you asked me that question earlier, I simply referred to the which is a report I urge everyone to read, Elitist Britain, that says that the relationship between the circumstances you're born into, in fact, how rich you're born, and the people that run this country is so strong that it looks like social engineering. That is a cross-party report in which the foreword is supplemented by John Major, David Cameron, Nick Clegg and Ed Miliband. So it's not even controversial.
I think I ought to have read it. So I'll tell you what we'll do on our show page this week, .org.uk. Oh, tonight we'll put a link in to...
Please put it up.
So people can... If you want to go on to the show and have a look at it.
At the time, I meant to... You know, busyness and all that with my family. But I meant to blog and say, I think this is one of the most important... reports that anyone could read this year, because again it brings some maturity to this question of when they kept talking about the ruling elite, where does this come from? 70% of judges coming from just 7% of our schools that are privately educated, over 50% of the cabinet privately educated, just 7% of the schools. Yeah. So the correlation is powerful and the correlation is a challenge. And let me just share one of the quotes from the report with you, which I think, I mean, I'm involved with a group that's writing a manifesto for race equality in Bristol. And we've included in that a quote from the report that says that correlation between your background, your wealth background, and who ends up in leadership is so strong that it looks like social engineering. And it also says, so we have to ask the question, to what extent does our current leadership reflect merit rather than background? The point about that is, so often when we step forward to take remedial action to redress the underrepresentation of women, people from black and Asian backgrounds, disabled people in leadership positions, they say, but you should be there on merit. You should be there on... Well, this report is saying that perhaps our current leadership isn't there on merit. They're simply there because they were born into wealthy, advantaged backgrounds.
And so you seem to be implying that people who are wealthy, advantaged backgrounds actually much prefer to be sitting around the table with other people who are from a similar income bracket, because it doesn't often get talked about as an equality issue. But wealth really is, isn't it?
I'm not implying it, I'm saying it. It's just that, I mean, and it is evidence as well. You know, you go into any HR practice, they will tell you there's a tendency for groups to recreate themselves in their own image, right? People, and, you know, when I was working at the BBC, there was a line I often heard, someone would say, I just trust that person's editorial judgment. What they really meant was, that person thinks like me. That's why I trust it.
This is. I wonder how influential that you think that mentality is in the media regionally.
Oh, it's ferociously powerful. I will give some kudos to Lucio Mosquita when he was head of BBC West and Tim Pemberton, though. I think Lucio shared a line where he was one of the first people.
Is this guy the boss of Points West? Basically.
He was, yeah.
Yeah, because it annoys me, but you don't see his name on the credits at the end, do you?
Lucio, I'm sure he does all right. But he was one of the first people to speak to me in a really kind of overt and coherent way about the importance of a diversity of thought, which I found was a really interesting term at the time. But now, over recent years, there are more and more organizations, including McKinsey, the global management consulting firm, that says actually having access to a diversity of thought makes for a better performing organization. And in fact, I recently wrote an article and just suggested, if we can talk about private sector companies like IBM, McKinsey and so forth saying that a diversity of thought makes them more money as organizations, then we need to look at places like cities, even like Bristol, and say that the absence of a diversity of thought at senior levels within this city, perhaps if you take the lessons from the private sector, would say that the quality of decision making is not where it could be if we did have greater representation of the population as it actually is, remembering that Bristol is one of the most diverse cities outside London, and the rate of diversity is increasing in any other city outside London. So actually it is incumbent upon Bristol that we begin to get a leadership in the city that reflects the population, one that rather than one that does not reflect the population.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, the Germans get this, don't they?
Get what?
What we've just been talking about, the
I
idea
just of some points. Were you listening?
Because they've got a proportional representation system in Germany, which leads to a diversity of views being expressed. And they have things in Germany, like the coalition at the moment is between the SPD and the CDU, which is a conservative socialist coalition. Unthinkable in this country, but in Germany regarded as a normal practice. Not necessarily a good practice, but they've got their own. They've got problems as well, though. In Germany, you have to have a German grandparent to be a citizen and to vote. So you've got a Turkish population there, several million people who've been born in Germany but still have not the right to vote. So they're excluded. So that's not diversity. And the other thing is that Die Linke Party in Germany, which is the former Communist Party, takes about 10% of the vote, mostly in the old East Germany. No other party will form coalitions with them because they are regarded as beyond the pale. And in actual fact, if they would, you could easily have an SPD Green Link Party coalition. The left have the majority even without the Turkish vote. So in many ways, Britain has got a better record on diversity than Germany. But Germany's got a much better income distribution than we've got.
So, Marvin, if you were to become mayor, how would you tackle this at the city level?
I've already made efforts on this. I've suggested that one of the platforms I'd love to offer is to make some real explicit city commitments around voter registration. Now, I'm not saying this is everything, but what you do is you tackle some of these gateway issues, don't you, right? So voter registration. I asked someone a little while ago, what is the city strategy around voter registration? They said we don't have one. We need some hard targets around this.
Well, I can tell you from my own personal experience, at home I asked for a form so I could actually register. Nothing at all appeared in the post.
The foundations of it. And I think because we had a visit a few months ago from one of the national leads for public health, and I suggested to them that maybe they make voter registration a public health indicator. The reason being, because I would hazard to guess, and you might be better on this than me, Martin, with your background, that if you looked at voter registration, it would probably be a fair indicator of whether people are employed, and there'd be a relationship, and actually health outcomes and people's sense of engagement and ownership of the communities and the cities of which they're a part. But like I said, it's only a first step. It has to go along with politicising your population, not party politicising them, but equipping people from a very early age with the tools to understand what questions are at stake in the city. I would like to see a kind of a rebirth of programmes, but for the general population, such as those run by Operation Black Vote, which is the way I got into party politics. But Operation Black Vote ran on the basis of trying to get more black and Asian people into elected office. And I would like to see more programmes like that, shadowing schemes where councillors, MPs and MEPs give people a chance to spend some time with them. The police are doing this now with their ride-along scheme. You know, come and see what it is actually like to be a police officer, see what we actually work with. I'd like to see faith groups. I think about Martin Luther King, who I quote too often and I'm a bigger fan of. But what people don't realise is one of the first things he did when he went to take over his church, his first church, was he started to run political seminar sessions, political education sessions for the congregation. I mean, how many of our churches do that? Say these are the pivotal questions of our time. I've just encouraged our churches at the moment. They're actually involved in this about writing a church's manifesto for the city, rather than sitting back next year and then saying to the politicians, tell us what you're going to come and do for us. Why don't they set their stall out as to what's important for them in Bristol, and then get the political candidates to come along and say how they're going to deliver what's important for the faith groups in the city.
Well, what about groups like the Local Enterprise Partnership, who have a big role in spending lots and lots of public money? We had a debate here in the run-up to the May elections, local elections, where it came up several times. Several of the candidates were saying, from different parties, saying, well, actually, this is a kind of unaccountable. So it seems as if quite a lot of this is moving away from the sort of sphere where a mayor, city council leader or whoever could have much of an influence. With the Local Enterprise Partnership, it's business making these appointments.
Well, we've had some good interaction with them, myself and Voska and some other voluntary groups, because we've been very concerned in many about the impact the economy can have on the population. And we were very concerned that what may come along was a model of economic development that basically was trickled down. That is, you earlier, you know, we create jobs and people will get jobs. That's a lazy assumption to make, because what happens is when you create a bunch of opportunity in a place, the people who are best positioned to take the opportunity take it. It's not necessarily evenly distributed, and you can end up compounding inequality. And in fact, I think one of the honest self-reflections that the Labour Party had was around its health policy, that it put a number of health initiatives in place. And it wasn't that, and actually inequalities became exacerbated because it was the best place position people who took those opportunities. I think we need to be really clear with the LEP that the economy has a purpose, and the economy is one of the key definers of the nature of our relationship and the quality of our society. I did have a meeting with someone from the LEP recently, a community meeting, and I was just dismayed to hear the representative say the LEP does not do social policy. I said economic development is social policy, right? The quality of jobs you create, whether you have an inclusive economy. I was just dismayed at the naivety of a statement like that. So I think we have to be clear. I mean, I've been involved with a piece of work. I was part of a group that did actually recruit an equalities representative. We don't like the idea of it, right? But an equalities representative, Diane Bunyan, who's a fantastic human being and ferociously... anything I say is going to sound condescending, but she's ferociously smart and I have the utmost faith in her. And Marty Burgess did some work around this as well, about making sure the LEP were taking very seriously the idea that they have responsibility for social inclusion and economic inclusion.
But they can say that, but then they can spend however many, or they don't actually do the spending. They recommend this big chunks of public money being spent on themselves, like Western College being given money by the LEP whilst they're one of the main LEP representatives around the table.
So I'm not going to cast any aspersions on what they do with the money. I mean, in any situation, someone could say something and then not do it, right? Jesus told that parable, didn't he, about the two sons. One said, I'm going to go and plough the field, and didn't do it. The other one said, I'm not going to do it, and he did. Which one obeyed? You know, so this is an ancient problem, right? But I think what we have to do is, what we need is people in positions of leadership in the city who understand that danger and are making clear when they're sitting at the table that their intention is to have a model of economic development that is inclusive. And in fact, what I would say is, you do inclusive economic development. And by inclusive economic development, I mean an economic development that benefits everyone and doesn't just share the benefits in a narrow elite. Not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it's the financially sensible thing to do. When people are excluded from economic development, when people are in a society that suffers from greater inequality, the evidence, unquantifiable amounts of evidence now, particularly from books like The Spirit Level, a book of someone I met when I was over at Yale, Betsy Bradley's just written a book on the American healthcare paradox, why they spend more on health but get worse outcomes. The evidence tells us that economic inequality and economic exclusion leaves people in a position where they're more likely to require publicly funded services. They need the benefits. They need the support to stay in their homes. When their families fall apart, they need family interventions. We need school interventions.
But we've got people at Westminster with totally other ideas. They prefer, actually, to send people on sanctions and food banks, this kind of thing.
Yeah, so vote for those who do understand that and who don't accept what I would call Dickensian approach to the world. And that's why voting, I made a little video, you can find it on my website, me boxing and all that, trying to show off my glory days. But, you know, I say voting isn't everything, but voting is something. And voting is infinitely more than not voting.
Well, there's a lot of people out there who say it's just no point. All these parties are the same and it's actually impossible to turn the tank around. It's going the wrong way, boys and girls.
Well, I don't think they're right. I was in the US in the late 90s and I met a fantastic African-American man, Larry Bellinger. And one of the things he said to me was, I don't vote Democrat, and this is not about me, but I don't vote Democrat because I think they'll do anything for me, but I know they won't do anything to me. Sometimes the important thing before getting radical policy passed is just to stop very adversarial policy being passed, right? So when I look at someone like Barack Obama and people saying, well, he didn't solve global poverty, he hasn't stopped climate change and all the things he didn't do.
He didn't close Guantanamo.
No, but what the major achievement of Barack Obama, as far as I'm concerned, from his first term, he kept Sarah Palin out of government, right? What the heck would have happened to African Americans if John McCain was there on the whip of the Tea Party with Sarah Palin? Barack Obama's first job was to keep the Republicans out. His second job was to stay electable, so he kept them out the next time round. Right? We'll talk about him passing radical policy and transforming the world after that. It is to stem the tide of a global order that drives towards increasing inequality and doesn't work for the advantage of the poor. Hold that back. Then when we've got our footing, we work out what radical policy we can pass. That's why voting is important. If you don't vote, you get what we've just got. A whole load of policy, £12 billion in welfare cuts, poor people being hit, privatisation in the NHS, and people losing any hope.
Well, talking about extremist policies, as we are there, sort of almost, anyway, David Cameron this week on Monday announced his new extremism strategy, and he's talking about the extremist doctrine. So let's have a listen to a clip from what he had to say.
What we're fighting in Islamist extremism is an ideology. It's an extreme doctrine. And like any extreme doctrine, it is subversive. At its furthest end, it seeks to destroy nation states to invent its own barbaric realm. And it often backs violence to achieve this aim, mostly violence against fellow Muslims who don't subscribe to its sick worldview. But you don't have to support violence to subscribe to certain intolerant ideas which create a climate in which extremists can flourish. Ideas which are hostile to basic liberal values, such as democracy, freedom, sexual equality. Ideas which actively promote discrimination, sectarianism and segregation. Ideas like those of the despicable far right, which privilege one identity to the detriment of the rights and freedoms of others. And ideas also based on conspiracy, that Jews exercise malevolent power, or that Western powers in concert with Israel are deliberately humiliating Muslims because they aim to destroy Islam. In this warped worldview, such conclusions are reached. That 9/11 was actually inspired by Mossad to provoke the invasion of Afghanistan. Or that British security services knew about 7/7, but didn't do anything about it because they wanted to provoke an anti-Muslim backlash. And like so many ideologies that have existed before, whether fascist or communist, many people, especially young people, are being drawn into it. We need to understand why it is proving so attractive.
That was David Cameron speaking on Monday this week. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, he's talking about quite a lot there, really saying that there is this this extremist doctrine, and he's laying it out there. It's to do with Jews and the West, also 9/11 being done by Mossad to get an invasion of Afghanistan. Also talking about 7/7, saying that actually it was done deliberately and MI5 allowed it to happen to provoke a Muslim backlash.
Well, it's interesting that he's picked up on these very widely understood aspects of the way the world actually works. I would like to say to David Cameron, there is overwhelming evidence that NATO intelligence services have been involved in fomenting terrorism in Western Europe from the 1950s onwards. So, for example, the Bologna bombing of 1980, which killed 86 civilians in Bologna railway station, according to the Italian Supreme Court, was carried out by NATO intelligence services. There's no doubt about it. Fernando Imposimato, who is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book which came out in 2012 called La Repubblica dei Strani Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. And he was the investigating magistrate on many of these incidents.
But that doesn't involve the British.
It does, because NATO intelligence services is the British. And when people...
But that was in Italy.
And let's bring it back to this country. The Panorama documentary that we saw a few weeks ago, one of the best things the BBC have done in years, exposed the fact that the British intelligence services were involved in hundreds of murders in Northern Ireland, basically running the Loyalist terror campaign. And that's according to Nuala O'Loan, who's the head of the Northern Ireland Police Ombudsman. Now, the Panorama did a very good job there. They doorstepped a former British Army general. They doorstepped a former Loyalist shooter. And the evidence has piled up. The Irish police are absolutely clear that the bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972 were carried out by the Glenaim gang with explosives supplied by British intelligence. Now, in the world lived in by David Cameron, all of this is conspiracy theory. In the world lived in West Belfast or in Bologna, that's not conspiracy theory, that's historical fact.
So was 9/11 carried out by Mossad to encourage an invasion of Afghanistan?
That's interesting you should mention that, because the fact is that on 9/11, on the day of 9/11, a white van was parked opposite the World Trade Center, and on top of that white van were five male individuals. When the first plane hit the World Trade Center, they were photographing, or rather videoing, the incident. And when it happened, they all did high fives and started cheering. Now, somebody saw that, reported it to the police, 8 hours later, that van was stopped, and inside that van were five Mossad agents, including Pierre Seglovitz. They were held, they were questioned for over 40 days, they were released, and they went back. Let me finish. They went back to Israel. On television in Israel, they said, we were not doing anything wrong, we were just documenting the event. Documenting a surprise attack.
Yes, well, that's what intelligence services do. They do have knowledge.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, the implication of that is that Mossad certainly had pre-knowledge of the attack, if not involvement in it. And, of course, when we're talking about 7-7, on the day, on the film that we worked on, Conspiracy Files, BBC film, they definitely, it was definitely the case, Netanyahu was in London that day, finance minister. He was supposed to go to a meeting at Liverpool Street that morning. He didn't go. And he didn't go because the Jerusalem Post phoned up the embassy and said, is he all right? Said, no, he didn't go because we had a warning and he didn't leave the building. Now, that's two events, 7-7 and 9-11, where we've got documented evidence that Israeli intelligence had pre-knowledge of those two events. Now, that doesn't mean they did it, but it certainly puts them in the frame. Now, David Cameron doesn't want to talk about this stuff. Brigadier Gordon Kerr was named by the head of the Metropolitan Police, Sir John Stevens, as being behind running the Loyalist terror campaign. In other words, hundreds of people were killed, but on his orders. Now, I'm naming names here, Brigadier Gordon Kerr. Now, David Cameron, David Cameron doesn't know about these things, in which case he's being misled by his senior officials, or he does, and he's part of the problem.
So if what David Cameron's talking about is not the extremist doctrine, what is the extremist doctrine?
Well, this idea that the extremist doctrine, let's unpick this a bit. We're being told that people are being self-radicalising online, and then they're going off to Syria to get involved in ISIS. Now, not long ago, the Turkish police arrested a British girl, 16 years old, on her way into Syria. They arrested also the guy who'd groomed her to go to Syria. And that guy turned out to be a Canadian intelligence agent. Is there anybody in the world who doesn't believe that NATO intelligence services in Turkey, in Jordan, in the Gulf states are not involved in arming and training and sending terrorists into Syria? They've been doing it for the last 4 or 5 years. I read in the Daily Telegraph today that the British are sending people to Saudi Arabia to train militants to be infiltrated into Syria. Now, at the same time, we're then going, oh, these terrible militants, what are we going to do? They're coming back to blow us all up. Now, the fact is that there's overwhelming evidence that the Western intelligence services have been involved in all of this. Now, he may call that conspiracy theory, but I just say bring it on, because if you try and take anybody like us to court to talk about this, we will relish it, because the evidence is overwhelming, and I think most ordinary people haven't really grasped it unless they have a knowledge. And of course, in certain parts of the world, people do have a knowledge of how this works. In Turkey, for example, Erdogan, who's the president of Turkey, he questioned whether the Charlie Hebdo attack was not such a false flag attack. Now, why would he say that? Well, because he's a Muslim. Well, it's actually because in Turkey, the top generals in Turkey were sent to prison for 25 years, not long ago, for being involved in exactly these kind of attacks, pretending to be Muslim extremists. And they were all sent to prison by the courts.
Okay, Marvin, now Martin's had his rant there. What do you make of all this and the speech that Cameron gave on Monday, identifying what he sees as the extremist doctrine?
Well, I mean, this is a piece of work I've been involved in the city from the time I was working at a Black Development Agency. We were given the task of working on PREVENT. We preferred not to call it PREVENT. We ended up developing a line of work called Building the Bridge, actually, and did a lot of reaching out and looking at the question of community cohesion. I mean, obviously, it's a flagship issue of our time, not because I walk around feeling in a permanent state of threat, but because it's on our screens, and there are thousands of people on the other side of the world that we care about that are being impacted by it, and it is blowing back into questions of belonging, identity, in Britain. I mean, I just have to keep reminding people that, you know, among my close Muslim friends, I mean, I have fantastic support from the mosque as well. Even though they know I'm a Christian, and they give me fantastic support. So I do remind people about that it is possible to live and love across what people perceive as boundaries, but we're all people of the book. I mean, my real concern is I just find it a little bit of a one-legged approach. You know, sometimes you believe things or not according to who said it. So I have less faith in Cameron's approach because of the worldview he brings with it. The point I'd like to say is, if you want to build strong communities in which people belong and feel they belong, you can't do it without talking about the issue of economic inclusion. I think it's a defining feature. I'm not saying that everyone who's gone off to go to Syria has been economically excluded or being poor.
But these, but I mean, as a we whole, don't have that economic
about a group
inclusion.
Of people who have been excluded from our
but
society.
We don't have that economic inclusion. And what Cameron's saying here is that these conspiracy theories are actually motivating people to become extremists where they might not otherwise. At the moment, we don't have that economic inclusion, do we?
No, and it undermines the strength of our societies. I think you can look at things from all different places as well. Think about the summer riots of 2011. A friend of mine who was watching on said the thing that interested him the most, he's a group psychologist, he said the thing that interested him the most was how our society became so weak that for no overt political cause people would just take to the roads in chaos, and that happened all over our country. So I think it's evidence of a very fragile society with very little resilience. And I think too, some of the conversation around Britishness and belonging, I'm very sensitive to it, right? I'm a mixed race man, and I enjoy sharing the fact that, you know, my family are called the Briars, and my nan's side, they're Bristolians going back centuries, right? One of my cousins has done our family tree. We go back to the workhouses in Bristol a couple of hundred years ago, right? The other side of my family is Welsh on my grandfather's side, and then the other side of that, my dad's obviously Jamaican, came here age 12. So this question of belonging and identity is one that's very sensitive to me. Now, sometimes when people start talking about integration, what I do like to remind people, it's not, one is the question of integrating into what, because are our societies as strong as they should be? But I think too, we've got to remember that people have tried to integrate and been kind of pushed away. My hope is that actually that my history, my story, my experiences of a mixed race, growing up as a mixed race man with blood that crossed all these boundaries, that we can do something about developing that understanding of identity and belonging, in which we are all and rather than either or, can play out in Bristol. But certainly we've got to have the really big question about identity, but it cannot be separated from the challenge of economic exclusion.
Okay,
and
we'll also be talking about the counter-extremism strategy also after the news some more, but for now we'll move on. Theresa May orders a probe into high levels of deaths in police custody. Campaigners say 380 deaths in England and Wales between 2002 and 2012 is too many. According to campaigners, there have been 380 deaths in England and Wales over those 10 years, as well as 290 deaths in police vehicle incidents. There have also been accusations that disproportionate numbers of people from black and minority ethnic communities after arrest have died following the use of force. And the investigation will examine the use of restraint by officers, ways of preventing suicides, and the availability of help for suspects with mental health problems. Marvin.
Absolutely. From David Bennett, who was in a mental health institution and restrained by a number of nurses, and when they got up he was dead in the 90s, which sparked the whole Delivering Race Equality and Mental Health Care programme, to Sean Reagan beyond. It's, you know, people have been dying in custody, healthy people have died in custody. It's absolutely unacceptable. Someone who's, I wouldn't say as a friend, but linked with me on through someone in the social media networks, was once kind of challenging me on it. And I said, look, come down. You know, my friend Saeed teaches wrestling down in Old Market. I guarantee you that we can get three or four of those guys to hold you on the floor without killing you. Yeah, it's not hard to hold someone on the floor without actually killing them. So, I mean, I chuckle not because it's funny, but because it's so ridiculous. The other sad dynamic within this is that many of the people who die and have mental health have been mental health service users. So what you have is, you have, and in fact, around the case of Sean Rigg, which was one of the cases, she was with Sean Rigg's sister when she made this announcement, which is a welcome announcement. You know, there'd been a whole series of failures around Sean Rigg, both in mental health services, in social interventions, and in the police. They had not joined up the dots. And so what happened was a very vulnerable adult with a health condition ended up a vulnerable adult in the criminal justice system, ended up dead. That's absolutely unacceptable, and I'm glad she's made the announcement. I just wish that in line with that, they hadn't imposed the cuts that they had on the legal system that's going to impact on people's abilities to get access to fair and equal legal representation. And I wish that along with that, that we didn't have Ian Duncan Smith sway them through the social security system, leaving people in very vulnerable conditions, in which some of them are even taking their own lives and getting worse health outcomes because their money's being cut.
This is a big issue
who are disabled
for the police, that they're not really interested in having to deal with the mentally ill. That's not their job. It shouldn't be anyway. A lot of police are annoyed about that anyway. Martin, this is three people a month dying in police custody at the moment.
Well, I think the obvious thing to say is that occasionally people die in custody and the circumstances are, everything's gone right, but there's just been an accident. But it can't be the case that thousands of people have died and not one single police officer has been found
responsible. Well, it's 380 over 10 years.
Isn't it? Yeah. Sometimes things will happen. But when repeatedly no one's at fault for it, then that sends a secondary signal that your life doesn't matter.
That's right,
isn't it? That's a problem. I do think, though, can I just say, the police are going to get a tough time about this, and absolutely deservedly so. They need to be under the microscope, just like anyone in any profession, in mental health services. Politicians need to be under the microscope. But I think what we also need to do alongside that is to really encourage those who are stepping up to the mark. And I just want to say, in the name of that encouragement, I think the commander of Bristol Police right now has been opening the books on a number of issues to a number of us, from myself, from Sari, from Voska, to come and say, hey, come and talk to us about how we're policing so we get the best quality policing we can in this city. And so absolutely recognising that, we need to go on this and go in on this hard. People should not be dying in custody in places of safety. Also to encourage those who are in those institutions saying, let's make things work right.
Tory anti-strike laws are like something from the Nazis, says trade union boss as he calls a second 24-hour tube strike. This is Daily Mail. Controversial government plans to make it harder for unions to call strikes are like something from Nazi Germany, the firebrand union chief behind week before last's London Underground shutdown has claimed. That's the ASLEF boss, Mike Whelan, Martin.
Isn't it interesting that you're calling ASLEF boss? He's not a boss, he's the elected leader of the workforce. This is just spitefulness. I mean, the attempt.
Well, who by?
By the government. Union they're attempting to make strikes illegal if called by trade unions. And I'd just like to remind them that in France, hardly anybody's a member of a trade union. And therefore, when people go on strike, they go on strike without a union. They just walk out. And of course, you can't sue people for doing that. And what happened in the underground in the 90s was, because of the difficulties of getting legal strikes, the train drivers used to have mass meetings which were closed to all outsiders, and then they all called in sick on Monday morning, so the union wasn't involved in any way, so that the union's funds were not going to be.
But this comparison to the Nazis is unfair, surely.
Well, no, I mean, the Nazis carried through laws against strikes. I mean, it's hyperbole.
Well, they banned unions in 1933.
And they banned strikes. And, of course, the goal is, and we know from the 30-year rule stuff about the Thatcher government, their policy was to basically get rid of trade unions in Britain. There was no doubt about it. In private, they were discussing, we want to get rid of trade unions. We don't want
trade
unions.
Didn't David Cameron get elected, or the Tory party, on 25% of the vote? So how would that work out indeed. in a strike?
25% of the electorate, yeah.
Marvin, what do you make? I mean, do you think it's fair to compare this to the Nazi banning of unions in 1933?
I'm always wary of such comparisons, because I think they can end up, the main point of the argument can end up being lost. As people make
but it got a headline in the Daily Mail.
I think the point you make about the threshold for being an elected representative compared to the threshold they're putting in place for people taking strike action is certainly on point. Chukwu Amuna made this point on Question Time last week. It says, like, it's a cheek, you know, for a politician to say that. I think, too, I don't even know if it's necessary. I think it's hard enough for people to take action already. Of course, no one wants strike, but that's your negotiating tool when you're a worker. And I think I would just say, lastly, you know, The Conservatives are saying they're the party of the worker. Well, that's the worker unless you get organised. You know, managers get organised. We have the Institute of Directors. We have all these bodies that the CBI that represent business and represent management and represent senior people. And by nature of running an organisation, they have an organised group of people who are there to pass policy. You know, unions are. All workers have to get together to organise, to have a united voice, and to try and have some power that they can stand for their rights, that they can get good pay, they can get holiday pay, they can get maternity pay. All these things came through our trade unions. I would suggest that rather than trying to, you know, to go to war with the unions, why don't we try to do a lot better job of pulling unions and business leaders together upstream to make decisions about the way the economy is going to work and the kind of economy we're going to get. Unions want a strong economy. Business want a strong economy. We need an economy, and the health service wants an economy that's good for workers because they don't end up needing mental health services and all those negative impacts. So
I want to get the views of both of you, Marvin, you first, on the Labour's abstention in the welfare bill, the second reading of the welfare bill as well, because that was quite controversial. I noticed, I think it was on Twitter, you know, basically there was an exasperation about the idea that Labour Party wouldn't bother to vote against it but would abstain. What do you think about that? The welfare bill.
Oh, you asking me?
Yeah,
first?
Yeah.
So that silence sounds like I didn't want to answer.
Sorry,
right?
No, go for it. We've got 4 minutes. Up. Yeah.
Tough one. Yeah. I wish they'd come out against, but I think that they're also battling. You know, politics isn't just about the decisions you make; it's about the battle in the media as well and the headlines that are told. And unfortunately, every story at the moment starts with a story of policy and comes down to a story of internal party dynamics. It's really important.
Why,
that
Martin?
MPs made a decision to show a united party.
Well, why, Martin? Do you think the Labour Party wouldn't vote against it?
Well, they should have voted against it. In my
well, why
view.
Not though?
Well, I think Harriet Harman's justification was that their focus groups are showing that the idea that the benefit cap, the idea that large families should have their benefits cut, is popular in the focus groups. Of the target people that they need to win in the next election in the marginals 5 years away. But I think, as Jeremy Corbyn pointed out at his meeting in Bristol last night, this is actually a matter of fundamental principle. A child born into a large family, third, fourth or fifth, has absolutely the same rights as any other child once they're alive. They should not be treated, this idea that, and if you're going to go down the road of saying, well, we're going, let's have a one child policy like in China, where the top leadership all have to have one child each to set an example.
So irrespective of that, just as a matter of principles, how we make decisions, I absolutely agree we need to have principles, but you also don't need to get into the point where you win the battle but lose the war as well. This comes within
it's
the cost.
Okay. It's a bit of a mess.
Okay.
It's been a bit
Our
of a
final
mess,
item, the government is to sell off public land and buildings worth billions in order to balance the budget. Now, I thought that this actually would be about selling off assets and not capital receipts, and it doesn't actually make any difference in the long run if you're selling off stuff like this. Marvin, what's your thoughts about this?
My thoughts are, as long as they're selling it for affordable housing and the public benefit is pulled into that calculation, then I'm okay. If they're just selling it off on the cheap and people can go and make a bundle of money out of it for no public good, then I'd have a real concern.
Well, they're saying mate, possibly up to £20 billion being raised by selling off public land.
Yeah, it's a one-time sale. You have to take the wider social benefit into account. You may make £20 billion, but if you create a condition in which you allow your mates to make £300, then there's a problem.
You know what, I would imagine a lot of business people are looking at this land going, that's exactly the land we want, Martin. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
affordable homes.
But they're not going to spend it on affordable homes, are they? They're going to spend it on bombing Syria.
No, I mean the land for affordable homes,
oh,
as well as
oh,
the
I
money
see.
Raised.
Oh, I see, yes.
So I'm looking at
but
the
I mean,
total the package.
I don't. This is the sort of thing where you're basically selling off the family silver, as Macmillan called it in his dotage, and they're calling that balancing the books. That's not balancing the books. That's eating your own capital.
So what would you do if you were Chancellor?
Well, you've got to change the macroeconomic policy fundamentally.
What would you actually do?
You've just left me 30 seconds.
Go on, yeah, sum it up in a nutshell.
Well, this is somebody. Keep it just about the same level, because otherwise you're going to crash the economy. The property bubble's about to burst.
Okay, thanks. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guests, one of the two shortlisted so far for Bristol's Labour Party mayor candidate, Marvin Rees.
Good evening.
After the news, we'll be back.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.